This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our program. We're reading from Ernest Gaines' novel, A Lesson Before Dying. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and will be made available in podcast after the broadcast. We're pleased to present these dramatic readings of A Lesson Before Dying using a cast of volunteer readers. Feel free to call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
On the sideboard, one of the girls, wearing a gray dress and a black sweater, unpolished brown loafers and unmatching brown stockings, her head a forest of half a dozen two-inch plates, had written a sentence of six words with a downward slant of nearly a foot. "And what is that supposed to be?" I asked her. She was so terrified by my voice that she jerked around to face me, then staggered back against the board. This, she stuttered while gesturing toward the board with a piece of chalk. That's a simple sentence, Mr. Wiggins. That's not a simple sentence, I told her. That's a slanted sentence. A simple sentence is written in a straight line. I reached for the piece of chalk, but in her fear of me, she continued to hold on to it, and I had to pry it out of her hand. I drew three straight lines from one end of the board to the other. Those are straight lines, I said. Do you notice the difference? She nodded her head while looking at me, not at the board. I erased the three lines, as well as her slanted sentence. "I want you to write me six simple sentences in straight lines," I said, and handed her the chalk. "You have until the end of the period to do it. The rest of the class, take your seats." I left her standing there, trying to figure out where to begin. At the door, I turned back to look at the other classes. They all knew I was in a pretty rotten mood today, and they kept their heads down. I went out into the yard, slapping the waistcoat ruler against my leg hard enough to sting it. The cool air felt good on my face, and after standing in the yard a while, I walked to the road. But there was nothing to see out there but a couple of automobiles. My gray Ford parked down the quarter in front of my aunt's house, and a car parked alongside the ditch farther up the quarter. Other than that, all there was to see were old gray weather-beaten houses, with smoke rising out of the chimneys and drifting across the corrugated tin roofs. Living and teaching on a plantation, you got to know the occupants of every house, and you knew who was home and who was not. I knew that the parents of the older brothers and sisters of the boy I had slashed on the butt with my ruler were out in the field, and that the old grandma, Aunt June, was at home cooking dinner for them to eat when they came in at noon. I could see the smoke rising from the kitchen chimney of the girl who stuttered, and I knew that she came from a family of 12, and that she had a pregnant older sister who was not allowed to come back to school, but had to work in the field with all the others, and that she had an idiot brother and a tyrant father, and that the father beat the pregnant girl and any other member of the family, including the mother, but would never touch the idiot whom he showered with love. I could look at the smoke rising from each chimney, or I could look at the rusted tin roof of each house, and I could tell the lives that went on in each one of them. I went all the way to the back of the yard where I used the boys' toilet. Then I returned to my classes, but instead of coming in through the front door as I had left, I entered through the back. Most of the students remembered the mood I was in and had their heads in their books. But one first grader had forgotten or didn't care, and he found time to play with a bug on the sleeve of his sweater. As I watched from the back door, he let the insect crawl an inch or two from his elbow toward his hand. Then he picked it up and returned it up his arm to let it start all over again. I looked at Irene Cole, my student teacher, to let her know not to warn him. And when I got in good striking distance of his nearly shaved head, I brought the waistcoat down on his skull loud enough to send a sound throughout the church. He jumped, hollered, grabbed at the already swelling knot. One or two of the students near him giggled nervously, but most remembered the mood I was in and seemed petrified. The boy with his hand cupped over the welt, was crying now. "Take that thing outside, get rid of it, and get back in here," I told him. He left, crying quietly, the little red bug sitting on top of his extended arm. "So it's bug playing time, huh?" I asked the rest of the class. "You think that's why I'm here? So that you can play with bugs? Huh?" The boy came back and sat down. His hand was still cupped over his scalp, and he was still crying. "The rest of you, back to your seats," I ordered. They moved hurriedly, quietly, careful not to utter a word. "Do you all know what is going on in Bayonne?" I asked them, back at my desk. "Do you all know what is going to happen to someone just like you, who sat right where you're sitting only a few years ago? All right, I'll tell you. They're going to kill him in Bayonne. They're going to sit him in a chair. They're going to tie him down with straps. They're going to connect wires to his head, to his wrists, to his legs, and they're going to shoot electricity through the wires into his body until he's dead." I looked across the room at them. Some stared back at me, others down at the floor, but they were all listening. They knew Jefferson was supposed to die in the electric chair, but they hadn't known how this would happen. It had not been explained to them so vividly before, and maybe not at all. I could see how painful it was for most of them to hear this, but I did not stop. "Do you know what his nanan wants me to do before they kill him? The public defender called him a hog, and she wants me to make him a man. Within the next few weeks, maybe a month, whatever the law allows, make him a man. Exactly what I'm trying to do here with you now, to make you responsible young men and young ladies. But you prefer to play with bugs. You refuse to study your arithmetic, and you prefer writing slanted sentences instead of straight ones. Does that make any sense?" "Well, does it?" No one answered. Most averted their eyes. I noticed that the girl, whom I had criticized at the blackboard, had lowered her head and was crying. "Estelle, leave the class if you can't control yourself," I ordered her. She shook her head, but she did not get up or look at me.
I'm all right, Mr. Wiggins, but that's my cousin."
I knew that Jefferson was her cousin, but I didn't apologize for what I had said, nor did I show any sympathy for her crying. "Either leave the class or stop crying," I told her again. She wiped her eyes, but she did not look up. "All right, the rest of the morning for studying," I told them. "And you better study, because I'm testing everybody this afternoon." At 2 o'clock, I was at the blackboard with my fifth graders when we heard a knocking on the front door. I told the boy nearest the door to see who it was and ask him to come in. The boy went to the door and came back alone. He said that it was Mr. Farrell Giroux, but Mr. Farrell didn't want to come in. I told the class to go on with their work, and I went to the door to see what he wanted. Farrell Giroux was a small, light brown man in his late 50s. He wore an old felt hat, a khaki suit, and worn work shoes. He was the yard man and all-around handyman for Henri Pichot. He fixed and sharpened tools for the big house, and he served as carpenter for the people in the quarter. He had made more benches, fixed more chairs and steps than you could number. He took off his hat as I approached him. He had known me all my life, and he knew my aunt and all my people before me. But since I had gone off to the university and returned as a teacher, he treated me with great respect. I went down the steps and into the yard.
"Professor?"
"Mr. Farrell."
"He say it'd be all right if you come up by 5 this evening."
"Is this about Jefferson?" I asked.
"Didn't tell me. Just say it'd be all right if you come up there about 5.
"Thank you, Mr. Farrell."
"My pleasure, Professor," he said.
He put on his hat, and I noticed his eyes. He knew why Henri Pichot wanted me up there all right, but Henri Pichot had not thought it was necessary to tell him. At his age, he was still only a messenger to run errands. To learn anything, he had to attain it by stealth or through an innate sense of things around him. He nodded to me, knowing that I knew he knew why Henri Pichot wanted to see me, and he walked away, head down.
Thank you. Chapter 6. Inez was in the kitchen when I came up the back stairs, and she opened the door before I had a chance to knock. I could tell she had been crying. She had wiped the tears from her cheeks, but I could see the marks under her eyes. "How are you, Inez?" "I'm making out," she said, not looking at me. "You know why he sent for me?" "Mr. Sam coming here at 5. I glanced at my watch. It was 5:10. "Can I get you a cup of coffee?" Inez asked. "No, thanks." "You want to sit down?" She still did not look at me. "I'm all right. I don't mind standing." I remembered how my aunt and Miss Emma had stood the night before. "I don't know," Inez said, shaking her head. "I just don't know. Now Mr. Lewis in there trying to get a bet." "A bet on what?" She looked at me directly for the first time. She had large eyes, brown and kind. I could see traces of tears that she had tried wiping away. "You can't get him ready to die." Henri Pichot didn't take that bet, did he? "I left them in there talking. Mr. Lewis say he got a whole case of whiskey he can bet on." "Henri Pichot?" "He ain't betting against you. He ain't betting on you, neither." "Smart man." Inez looked at me sadly. I didn't know if it was because of my cynicism or the task I had facing me. She went back to the stove. With a dish towel, she lifted the lid of one of the pots, and I could smell a strong scent of onion, bell pepper, and garlic. She raised the lids on 2 other pots, but still the odor of the onions, pepper, and garlic pervaded the room. Inez left the kitchen. I heard her knock on the library door, and I could hear her and Henri Pichot talking. Then she came back into the kitchen. "How's Lou?" she asked me. "She's all right," I said. "I left her there with Miss Emma." I thought about them sitting at the kitchen table at Miss Emma's house. I had gone home after school to drop off my satchel, and when I did not find my aunt at home, I figured she was keeping Miss Emma company. I found them at the kitchen table, shelling pecans into 2 big aluminum pans. I could see that neither my aunt nor Miss Emma had any intention of going up to Henri Pichot's house with me. "But if you need me to hold your hand, I'd be glad to go," my aunt said. "I don't want him doing nothing he don't want do," Miss Emma repeated, the old refrain I had heard about 100 times the day before. I didn't answer them. I was angry already, and I knew things would just have gotten worse if I said anything else. I went back outside and got into my car and drove up to Pichot's. Now I looked at my watch again. It was 5:15. No Sam Guidry and no one else except Inez had come into the kitchen to say anything to me. Each time she returned from the library, Inez seemed more agitated. I knew she was feeling sorry for me. At 5:30, we heard people entering the house off the front gallery. Inez left the kitchen to meet them. She spoke to Edna Guidry, then to Sam Guidry, and to 1 or 2 other people. I could hear them talking as they came into the house. Inez returned to the kitchen with 2 empty glasses to be freshened. She added 4 glasses to her tray. She took that to the library and came back. "I'm sure it won't be too long now," she said. She knew how I felt, and she was trying to encourage me. It was 6:15. At 6:00, Edna Guidry came back into the kitchen, a tall woman in her early 50s. She had light brown hair, a narrow face, and gray eyes. She wore a shapeless black dress, gray stockings, and low-heeled black shoes. "Well, Grant! Grant, how are you?" she said, smiling and coming up to me with her hand out. She stopped a good distance back, and I had to lean forward to shake her hand, which was long and bony, and cold from her glass. "Why, Grant," she said, "I just do declare I haven't seen you in God knows how long. Been 2-3 years, I'm sure, wouldn't you say?" "About that long, Miss Edna," I said. "God, yes," she said. "Why, you're looking just as fine, like you're living the good life, doesn't he, Inez?" "He's looking just fine, Miss Edna," Inez said from the stove. "Well, tell me all about yourself," Edna Guidry said to me. "Have you been?" No need to tell me. I can see you're doing just fine. But how is Lou? Why doesn't she come to see me? It's been how long? Oh, I bet you it's been 8 months, and living so close. You tell Lou, I say, make you bring her to my house so we can sit down and talk. Lord have mercy, do," she turned from me to Inez. "Mr. Henri says you may serve any time now, Inez." "Yes, ma'am," Inez said. Edna turned back to me. "Grant, please tell Emma how sorry I am about Jefferson. I would do it myself, but I'm just too broken up over this matter. I ran into Madame Gropey just the other day. Lord, how sad she looks. Just dragging along. Poor old thing. I had to put my arms round her. Edna drank from her glass. Tell Emma I'm sorry. I'm sorry for both families. I hear you would like the privilege of visiting Jefferson. Yes, ma'am. Well, I'll leave that up to you all and the sheriff, she said. He'll talk to you after supper. She turned to Inez. Inez, is there anything that I may help you with? No, I got everything under control, Inez told her. Well, in that case, I may as well help myself to another quick shot. She poured about 2 ounces of bourbon into her glass and added ice cubes. After drinking half of it, she went back to the library. Inez dished up the food. She had cooked a pot roast with potatoes and carrots, onions, bell pepper, and garlic. She also had rice and mustard greens, green peas, and cornbread. She took the platters and bowls to the dining room. "Can I fix you something?" she asked me when she came back to the kitchen. "No, thank you," I told her. I was hungry. I hadn't eaten anything but a sandwich since breakfast. But I would not eat at Henri Pichot's kitchen table. I had come through that back door against my will, and it seemed that he and the sheriff were doing everything they could to humiliate me even more by making me wait on them. Well, I had to put up with that because of those in the quarter, but I damn sure would not add hurt to injury by eating at his kitchen table. Inez went to the dining room and came back. "They're talking up there now about him," she said. "Sheriff saying he don't like the idea at all, saying nobody can make that thing a man, saying might as well let him go like he is." "I hope that's his final word," I said. "It sure would relieve my mind." "Why don't you sit down?" Inez said. "You'll feel better." "I'd rather stand." "You sure I can't fix you a little something to eat?" "No, thank you, Inez." She went and came back. "Won't be long now," she said. "They nearly through. Soon as I serve the coffee. You sure I can't get you a cup of coffee?" "No, thanks. I appreciate it, though." She poured coffee into half a dozen small white cups and took the coffee, sugar, cream to the dining room on a silver tray. She came back. "He asked me if you was still here," she said. "I think he gonna let you see him, but he say he's still against it. I'm sure it's Miss Edna making him do it. Well, all the time Miss Emma done spent with his family, they ain't asking too much." At 7:15, Inez cleared off the table in the dining room and brought the dishes into the kitchen. Then she took a bottle of brandy back with her. A half hour later, while she was putting away the dishes she had just finished washing, Sam Guidry, Henri Pichot, Louis Rougon, and another fat man came into the kitchen. I had been standing there nearly 2.5 hours. Sam Guidry was a tall man, well over 6 feet, and he was well tanned. His hair was dark brown, his sideburns and mustache showed some gray. His face was narrow, well-lined, and strong. His hands were large and hairy. He wore a brown suit and a tie. He usually wore a Stetson hat and cowboy boots. He had probably left the hat in the library or the dining room, but he had the boots on. The four white men split into pairs. Sam Guidry and Henri Pichot stood on one side of the table, while Louis Rougon and the fat man stood over by the dish cabinet. They had brought their drinks with them. Inez left the kitchen as soon as the white men came in. I tried to decide just how I should respond to them, whether I should act like the teacher that I was, or like the nigger that I was supposed to be. I decided to wait and see how the conversation went. To show too much intelligence would have been an insult to them. To show a lack of intelligence would have been a greater insult to me. I decided to wait and see how the conversation would go. "Been waiting long?" Sam Guidry asked me. "About 2.5 hours, sir," I said. I was supposed to say, "Not long," and I was supposed to grin, but I didn't do either. The fat man glanced knowingly at Louis Rougon. But Louis Rougon was looking directly at me. I could see in their faces that they had talked all this over, and Sam Guidry had already made up his mind what he was going to do. "What can I do for you?" he asked. Louis Rougon and the fat man waited for my answer. I knew it didn't matter what I said, since Guidry had made up his mind. Henri Pichot, standing next to Guidry, looked more tired than he had the day before. He seemed more sympathetic. Maybe he had been thinking about all the services Miss Emma had provided for his family over the years. "It's about Jefferson, Sheriff Guidry," I said. I knew they had discussed it. Still, I had to go through the motions. "His Nan Nan would like for me to visit him." What for? Guidry asked. They had discussed this, too. I could tell from the way the fat man drank from his glass. I could see in his face that he was amused. So was Louis Ragon. I knew they were both betting against me. She's old, I said. She doesn't feel that she has the strength to come up there all the time. She doesn't, huh? Sam Guidry asked me. He emphasized doesn't. I was supposed to have said don't. I was being too smart. Yes, sir, I said. She doesn't feel that she can. I used the word doesn't again, but I did it intentionally this time. If he had said I was being too smart and he didn't want me to come to that jail, my mind would definitely have been relieved. What about the preacher in the quarter? Can't he visit him? I asked her the same thing. You did, huh? Yes, sir. And what did she say? She said there'll be time for the preacher. She did, huh? Yes, sir. So she feels that he has that much time, time for the teacher and preacher? The fat man grunted. Louis Ragon's eyes showed that he was amused. Henri Pichot, next to Sam Guidry, looked uncomfortable. What you plan on doing when you come up there? If I let you come up there? Guidry asked me. I have no idea, sir, I told him. You're not trying to play with me now, are you? Guidry asked. No, sir, I'm not, but I have no idea what I'll talk to him about. I hear from people round here that you want to make him a man for what, at this time? She asked me to go to him, sir. Her idea, not mine. That was not the question, Guidry said. Make him a man for what? To die with some dignity, I suppose. I suppose that's what she wants. You think that's a good idea? That's what she wants, sir. What do you think? I would rather not have anything to do with it, sir, but that's what she wants. So you think he ought to go just like he is? I don't know how he is, sir. Believe me, Mr. Guidry, if it was left up to me, I wouldn't have anything to do with it at all, I said. You and I are in accord there, he said, but my wife thinks different. Now, which one you think is right, me or her? The fat man snorted. He thought Guidry had me. I make it a habit never to get into family business, Mr. Guidry. The fat man didn't like that quick maneuver. I could see it in his face. You're smart, Guidry said. Maybe you're just a little too smart for your own good. I was quiet. I knew when to be quiet. I don't like it, Guidry said. And I want you to know I don't like it, because I think the only thing you can do is just aggravate him trying to put something in his head against his will. And I'd rather see a contented hog go to that chair than an aggravated hog. It would be better for everybody concerned. There ain't a thing you can put in that skull that ain't there already. I remained quiet. You can come up there, Sam Guidry said, but the first sign of aggravation, I'm calling it off. You understand? Yes, sir. You have any questions? He asked me. Yes, sir. When can I see him? You can come any time you like. Not before 10 in the morning, not after 4 in the evening. Any other questions? Any idea how much time he has left? That's entirely up to the governor, not me, Guidry said. But I wouldn't plan on a diploma, okay? The fat man and Louis Ragon seemed impressed by the sheriff's questions and answers to me. Louis Ragon, who had light blue eyes, stared at me to make me look back at him, but I refused to pay him the courtesy. The fat man, drinking, rattled the ice cubes in his glass. Henri Pichot appeared to wish all this was over with. Anything else? Guidry asked me. When can I start coming up there? Not for a couple of weeks, Guidry said. Let him get used to it. Report to Chief Deputy Clark if I'm not around. Don't bring anything up there you don't want taken away from you. Knife, razor blade, anything made of glass. Not that I expect him to do anything, but you can never be sure. Anything else? No, sir, nothing else. Guidry nodded. Good luck, but I think it's all just a waste of time. Thank you, sir. I waited until they had left the kitchen, then I went out to my car and drove away.
Chapter 7. Two things happened at the school during the weeks before I visited Jefferson in jail. The superintendent of schools made his annual visit, and we got our first load of wood for winter. We heard on Monday by Pharrell Giroux, who had gotten the news from Henri Pichot, that the superintendent was going to visit us sometime during the week, but we didn't know what day or time. I told my students to take baths each morning and wear their best clothes to school. After the Pledge of Allegiance in the yard and the recitation of Bible verses inside the church, I would send a student back outside to look for the superintendent. If the student saw a car, any car, turn off the highway down into the quarter, he or she was supposed to run inside and tell me. The superintendent didn't show up until Thursday. By then we had had many false alarms. The minister of the church, who didn't live in the quarter, had made a couple of visits to church members. A doctor had come once, a midwife had visited a young woman twice, an insurance man had shown up, a bill collector from a furniture store had appeared. Henri Pichot had driven through the quarter at least once each day, and family and friends of people in the quarter had also visited. On Thursday, just before 2 o'clock, the boy I had watching for cars ran into the church. "Another one, Mr. Wiggins, another one." "All right," I said to the class. "Keep those books opened and look sharp." I passed my fingers over my shirt collar and checked the knot of my necktie. I felt my jacket to be sure both flaps were outside the pockets. I had three suits, navy blue, gray, and brown. I had on the blue one today. In the yard, I passed the tips of my shoes over the backs of my pants legs. Now I was ready to receive our guest. This time it was the superintendent. He stopped his car before the door of the church. A thick cloud of gray dust flew up over the top of the car and down into the quarter. The superintendent was a short, fat man with a large red face and a double chin, and he needed all his energy to get out of the car. "Dr. Joseph," I said. "Stifling," he said. I thought I was a little cool myself, but I figured that anyone as heavy as he was must have felt stifled all the time. He wheezed his way across the shallow ditch that separated the road from the churchyard. He looked up at me, but I could tell he didn't remember my name, though he had visited the school once each year since I had been teaching there. "Grant Wiggins," I said. "How are you, Higgins?" "Wiggins, sir," I said. "I'm fine." "Well, I'm not," he said, "all this running around. More schools to attend." Dr. Joseph visited the colored schools once a year, the white schools probably twice, once each semester. There were a dozen schools in the parish to visit, if that many. "We're honored that you took this time for us, sir," he grunted, looked around the yard. There was a good breeze coming in from the direction of the cane fields, and it wavered the flag on the pole in the yard. "Place looks about the same," Dr. Joseph said. "Things change very slowly around here, Dr. Joseph," I said. I motioned for him to precede me into the church. He needed all his strength to go up the three wooden steps, and as he entered the doorway, I heard Irene Cole, the sixth-grade student in charge, call out to the class, "Rise! Shoulders back!" I followed Dr. Joseph down the aisle, and on either side of us, the students from primer through sixth grade stood as still and as straight as soldiers for inspection. I nodded toward my desk for Dr. Joseph to take my chair. He grunted, which meant thanks, and pulled the chair further from the desk before he sat down. He needed the extra distance for comfort. Irene was watching me all the time, and when I nodded to her, she called out to the classes, "Seats!" And the whole school sat as one. We have been rehearsing this morning and afternoon for the past 3 days. "Students, I'm sure you all know Dr. Joseph Morgan," I told them. "Dr. Joseph is our superintendent of schools here in St. Raphael Parish. He has taken time out of a very busy schedule to visit us for a few minutes. Please respond loudly, 'Thank you, Dr. Joseph,'" which they did, loudly. Dr. Joseph acknowledged their greeting. "Dr. Joseph, we're at your service," I said, and sat down on one of the benches against the wall. Dr. Joseph leaned back in the chair, and still his large stomach nearly touched the edge of the table. He looked over the classes from one side of the aisle to the other, as though he was trying to catch someone doing something improper. "Primer, on your feet," he said. They stood up, seven or eight of them. Dr. Joseph looked them over for a moment. Then he told a little girl at the end to come forward. She took a deep breath and looked at the girl standing beside her before coming up to the desk. She was afraid, but she came up quickly and stood before the table with her little arms tight to her sides. She would not look up. "Nothing to be afraid of, child," Dr. Joseph said to her. "What is your name?" "Gloria Hebert," she said. "I can't hear you if you keep your head down," Dr. Joseph told her. She looked up timidly. "Gloria Hebert." "That's a pretty name," Dr. Joseph said. "Hold out your hands." She must have thought that she had done something wrong, because as she held her hands out across the table, palms up, I could see them trembling. "Turn them over," Dr. Joseph told her. She did. Mm-hmm, he said. Relax. She did not know what he wanted her to do. Lower your arms, child, Dr. Joseph said. She brought her arms back to her sides and lowered her eyes as well. Did you say your Bible verse this morning, Gloria?
Yes, sir, Dr. Joseph.
Well, what did you say? He asked her.
I said, Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, Dr. Joseph.
Dr. Joseph said. Seems I've heard that one before, but you're a bright little girl. You tell your folks Dr. Joseph said they ought to be proud of you. Go back to your seat.
Thank you, Dr. Joseph, she said, bowing and turning away quickly. She smiled as she faced forward again, but no one else was smiling.
Primers, take your seats, Dr. Joseph said. First graders, on your feet. And he called on the one boy in class who I wished had stayed home today. He was without doubt the worst child in the school. He came from a large family, 13, 14, 15, I don't know how many, and he had to fight for every crumb of food he got. At school, he did the same. He fought if he played marbles. He fought if he played ball. He fought if he played hide-and-go-seek. He fought if he played hide-the-switch. In class, he fought with those who sat in front of him, beside him, behind him. I had punished him as much during the last month as I had all the other children put together. Dr. Joseph asked his name, and he ran together three words even I couldn't understand. His name was Lewis Washington, Jr., but what he said didn't sound anything like that. Your hands, Dr. Joseph told him. The hands had been cleaned an hour before, I was sure, because I had checked each pair when the students came in from dinner. But now the palms of those same hands were as black and grimy as if he had been pitching coal all day. Did you pledge allegiance to the flag this morning? Dr. Joseph asked him. Yes, sir, he said. Not yes, sir, as I told him 100 times to say. Yes, sir. Well, Dr. Joseph said. You want me to go stand outside and salute flag? The boy asked. You don't have to go outside, Dr. Joseph said. You can show me in here. The boy raised his hand to his chest. Pledge legend to the flag. 90 state, America. Yeah, which it stand. Visibly. Amen. Dr. Joseph grunted. Several students giggled. Dr. Joseph seemed quite satisfied. I would have to do a lot more work. For the next half hour, it continued. Dr. Joseph would call on someone who looked half bright. Then he would call on someone whom he felt was just the opposite. In the upper grades, 4th, 5th, and 6th, he asked grammatical, mathematical, and geographical questions. And besides looking at hands, now he began inspecting teeth. Open wide, say ah. And he would have the poor children spreading out their lips as far as they could while he peered into their mouths. At the university, I had read about slave masters who had done the same when buying new slaves, and I had read of cattlemen doing it when purchasing horses and cattle. At least Dr. Joseph had graduated to the level where he let the children spread out their own lips, rather than using some kind of crude metal instrument. I appreciated his humanitarianism. Finally, when he felt that he had inspected enough mouths and hands, he gave the school a 10-minute lecture on nutrition. Beans were good, he said, not only just good, but very, very good. Beans, 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 he must have said beans 100 times. Then he said fish and greens were good, and exercise was good. In other words, hard work was good for the young body. Picking cotton, gathering potatoes, pulling onions, working in the garden, all of that was good exercise for a growing boy or girl. Higgins, I must compliment you. You have an excellent crop of students, an excellent crop, Higgins. You ought to be proud. He had said the same thing the year before, and he had called me Higgins then, too. And the year before, he had said the same thing, but he had called me Washington then. At least he was getting closer to my real name. Rise, Irene said to the class. They came to their feet, their heads up, their arms clasped to their sides. But instead of feeling pride, I hated myself for drilling them as I had done. Dr. Joseph and I went down the aisle. Outside, he looked up at the flag waving on its bamboo pole in the corner of the fence. I thought for a moment the superintendent was about to salute it, but he was either too tired or too lazy to raise his hand. Doing a good job, Higgins, he said. I do the best I can with what I have to work with, Dr. Joseph, I said. You know, I don't have all the books I need. In some classes, I have 2 children studying out of 1 book, and even with that, some of the pages in the book are missing. I need more paper to write on. I need more chalk for the blackboards. I need more pencils. I even need a better heater. We're all in the same shape, Higgins, he said. I didn't answer him. I said, we're all in the same shape, Higgins. The white schools just as much as the colored schools. We take what the state gives us. We make the best of it.
Many of the books I have to use are hand-me-downs from the white schools, Dr. Joseph, I said, and they have missing pages. How can I... Are you questioning me, Higgins? No, sir, Dr. Joseph. I was just... Thank you, Higgins. He started to get back into his car. It was harder to do than getting out, because he was upset with me now. More drill on the flag, Higgins, he said through the roll-down window. More emphasis on hygiene. Some of these children have never seen a toothbrush before coming to school, Dr. Joseph. Well, isn't that your job, Higgins? Yes, sir, I suppose so, but then I would have to buy them. Can't they work? He asked me. Look at all the pecan trees. He waved his hand toward the yards. I wager you can count 50 trees right here in the quarter. Back in the field, back in the pasture, you can count another 100, 200 trees. Get them off their lazy butts. They can make enough for a dozen toothbrushes in one evening. That money usually goes to helping the family, Dr. Joseph. Then you tell the family about health, he said, looking out of the rolled-down window to let me know that his visit was over. I have another school to visit. All this running around enough about to give a man a heart attack. He drove away. I stood there until he had turned his car around and started back up the quarter. I waved at him, but he did not wave back.
Chapter 8. The week after the superintendent paid his visit to the school, we got our first load of wood for the winter. Two old men brought the wagon load about 11 o'clock that morning. We did not have a gate wide enough for the wagon to come through, so the men came into the yard next door to the church. One got down off the wagon to open the gate, and the other drove the wagon into the yard. I could not see them, but I could hear them. They were joking about the mules, the wood, and the weather. One of them said, "Don't let Bird hang us up in the ditch now. I don't feel like unloading all this wood way out here and gotta put it in that wagon again." "She gone pull," the other one said. "Hey there, Bird, get them shoulders in there." I heard the wagon across the ditch and enter the yard. "All right," I said to the class. "The first one who looks outside will spend an hour in the corner. They can do pretty well without you." The wagon came further into the yard on the other side of the fence, passing the church windows. I could see the two mules, one big and red, the other small and dark brown with long, droopy ears, pulling hard in the chains. Then I saw the long poles of wood stacked high up on the wagon, with one of the old men riding atop the wood, while the other, the one who had the gate open, walked alongside the wagon. They were still joking and laughing. "Lewis Washington, Jr., get back into that corner and face the wall." "But, Mr. Wiggins, now you was looking out that window, too, now. I seen you." "Just out of the corner of my eye," I said. "Now, I was just looking out of the corner of my eye, too, Mr. Wiggins." "In that case, I won't punish you for looking out the window," I said. "But I'm going to punish you for using bad grammar. You were supposed to say, 'You were looking out the window, Mr. Wiggins,' not 'You was looking out the window, Mr. Wiggins.' Get back in that corner and face the wall and stay there. One more word out of you and you'll spend the rest of the day standing on one leg." Sitting at my desk, I could hear the old men unloading the wood, throwing the long poles across the fence and into the churchyard. They were still kidding each other. "Show me them grits. Show me them grits you had this morning." "I got my end up." "Well, I got the heavy end." "You sure got that right." They both laughed. And I heard the wood come across that fence. This went on for about a half an hour, then one of the men knocked on the back door. I went to see what he wanted. "Professor," he said, and smiled. Henry Lewis was a short black man with hardly any teeth. His hands were the color and texture of the legs of a snapping turtle. He wore an old straw hat, a green and brown plaid shirt, khaki pants, and rubber boots. He had grandchildren in the school. "Some wood there," he said. "I'm leaving the saw and a couple of them axes. Your boys can chop it up." "Appreciate it, Mr. Lewis," I said. "Glad to be of service." I spoke to Amos Thomas, who sat on the wagon. The thin, brown-skinned man nodded at me. "That ought to hold you for a while," Mr. Lewis said to me. "Just call for it run out. Somebody get you another load." "Thanks," I said. "Bye, Professor." "Goodbye, Mr. Lewis. Mr. Thomas." I returned to my desk. All right, I said to the class, it's 11:45 now. I'm letting you out early because you'll have to chop this wood this afternoon. I want you all back up here by 12:30. That afternoon, I stood by the fence while the 5th and 6th grade boys sawed and chopped the wood. Smaller boys and all the girls were inside. They wanted to know why they had to study while the older boys were outside having fun. I told them that they could have fun the next day picking up chips and stacking wood while the older boys were inside studying. They did not see this as quite the same, but when I didn't give them any other choice, they grudgingly relented. I gave them assignments and left Irene Cole in charge. Standing by the fence, I watched the 5 older boys saw and chop the wood. 2 would saw while another would straddle the wood pole to keep it steady. The other 2 boys split logs and chopped up small branches with the axes. They laughed and kidded each other while they worked. And I thought to myself, what am I doing? Am I reaching them at all? They are acting exactly as the old men did earlier. They are 50 years younger, maybe more, but doing the same thing those old men did who never attended school a day in their lives. Is this just a vicious circle? What am I doing? Am I doing anything? After a while, they exchanged the saw and axes. The ones who had been sawing were now splitting logs, and the other 2 were pulling on the handles of the saw. The smallest boy still held the logs as steady as he could with his hands and knees. With my back to the fence as I watched them, I remembered when it was I who had swung that axe and pulled my end of the saw. And I remembered the others, too. Bill, Jerry, Claude D., Smitty, Snowball, all the others. They had chopped wood here, too. Then they were gone. Gone to the fields, to the small towns, to the cities, where they died. There was always news coming back to the quarter about someone who'd been killed or sent to prison for killing someone else. Snowball stabbed to death at a nightclub in Port Allen. Claude D., killed by a woman in New Orleans. Smitty, sent to the state pen at Angola for manslaughter. And there were others who did not go anywhere but simply died slower. The big mulatto from Pulaya had predicted it, hadn't he? It was he, Matthew Antoine, his teacher then, who stood by the fence while we chopped the wood. He had told us then that most of us would die violently, and those who did not would be brought down to the level of beasts. Told us that there was no other choice but to run and run. That he was living testimony of someone who should have run. That in him, he did not say all this, but we felt it. There was nothing but hatred for himself as well as contempt for us. He hated himself for the mixture of his blood and the cowardice of his being, and he hated us for daily reminding him of it. No, he did not tell us this, but daily he showed us this. As clearly as anything, he showed us his hatred for himself and for us. He could teach any of us any old thing, and that one thing was flight. Because there was no freedom here, he said it, and he didn't say it. But we felt it. When we told our people how we felt, they told us to go back and learn all we could. There were those who did go back to learn, others who only went back. And having no place to run, they went into the fields. Others went to small towns and cities seeking work, and did even worse. But she told me that I would not be one of the others. That I would learn as much as he could teach me, and then I would go away to learn from someone else, but that I would learn as much as he could teach me, and then when he saw I wanted to learn, he hated me even more than he did the others, because I challenged him when the others did not. The others believed what he said. They went out into the fields, went into the small towns and into the cities and died. "So you think you can," he said. "So you think you can." No, he did not say it with words. Only with his eyes. "You will be the loser, my friend." Maybe he did not say friend. He probably didn't say friend. Fool, more likely. "Anyway, you will be the loser," he said. "Yes, I will teach you. You want to learn? I'll help you learn. Maybe in that way I'll be free, knowing that someone else has taken the burden. Good, good. You want to learn? Good, good. Here's the burden." Even after I'd gone away for further education, on returning to the plantation to visit my aunt, and I could still see the hatred in him. And after he'd retired from teaching because of ill health and I would visit him at his home in Puluya, I would still feel the hatred for himself, for me, for the world. Once, as I sat at the fireplace with him, he said to me, "Nothing pleases me more than when I hear something wrong. Hitler had his reasons, even the Ku Klux Klan of the South for what they do." "You don't believe me, do you?" he asked me. "No, sir, I don't," I said. "You will one day," he said. I told you what you should have done, but no, you want to stay. Well, you will believe me one day when you see those 5.5 months you spend in that church each year just a waste of your time. You will. You will. You'll see it, and you'll take more than 5.5 months to wipe away, peel, scrape away the blanket of ignorance that has been plastered and replastered over those brains in the past 300 years. You'll see. Then he'd be quiet for a long time while we both stared into the fire. I'm cold, he said one day while we sat there looking into the fire. I got up to put on another piece of wood. That's no good, he said. I'll still be cold. I'll always be cold. He looked at me. You'll see. You'll see. I must, I said. No, you don't must, he said. You want to, but you don't must. You did, I said. Yes, I did, he said. But I told you not to. I told you to go. God has looked after them these past 300 years without your help. He won't. God, I said, because I had never heard him say God before. Because when we had said our Bible verses for him, he seemed to have hated the very words we spoke. Sir, did I hear you say, I'm cold, he cut me off. I stay cold. You better go. Come back here some other time if you like. I made a mistake. I came back a month later. I remember that it was cold that day, too. Now, about that mulatto teacher and me, there was no love there for each other. There was not even respect. We were enemies of anything at all. He hated me, and I knew it, and he knew I knew it. I did not like him, but I needed him. I needed him to tell me something that none of the others could or would. I brought some wine that day. He sent me into the kitchen to get 2 glasses. This'll warm you up, I said. Nothing can warm me up, he said. He sat in the rocker, gazing down at the fire, with a blanket tight around him. He was a big-boned man, but very skinny now. To flight, he said, raising his glass. But you didn't go, I said. I'm Creole, he said. Can't you tell? Was that it? I asked. That was it, he said. I'm Creole. Do you know what Creole is? A lying, cowardly bastard. Did you know that? No, I didn't know that, I said. I was afraid, he said, looking into the fire. I was afraid to run away. What am I? Look at me. Where else could I have felt superior to so many but here? Is that important? I asked him. It is, he said. For everyone, especially for the whites and the near whites, it is important. Do you feel superior to me? I asked him. Course, he said. Don't be a damn fool. I am superior to you. I am superior to any man blacker than me. Is that why you hate me? I asked him. Exactly, he said, because that superior son of a bitch out there said I am you. Do you think he is superior to you? I asked him. Of course, he said. Don't you? No, I said. Just stay here long enough, he said. He'll make you the nigger you were born to be. My only choice is to run, then, I asked him. That was your choice, but you won't. You want to prove I'm wrong. Well, you'll visit my grave one day and tell me how right I was. Tell me more, I said. What's wrong with that university, he asked. Don't they tell you? They tell me how to succeed in the South as a colored man. They tell me about reading, writing, and arithmetic. I need to know about life. I can't tell you anything about life, he said. What do I know about life? I stayed here. You have to go away to know about life. There is no life here. There's nothing but ignorance here. You want to know about life? Well, it's too late. Forget it. Just go on and be the nigger you were born to be, but forget about life. You make me tired, and I'm cold. The wine does not help. I visited him again only a month or two before he died, in the winter of 42. He was 43 years old. That was my first year as a teacher. I'd been teaching 2 or 3 weeks when I visited him. We had just gotten our first load of wood for winter. Maybe that's why I'd gone to see him. I could always remember that first load of wood for the winter, how we older boys had chopped the wood into smaller pieces while he stood back against the fence overseeing us. He looked terribly frail that day. I hadn't seen him in several months. who's being looked after by a relative who did not care too much for anyone visiting him, especially darker people. She admitted me into the room and left us. He sat at the fireplace. Summer or winter, he always sat at the fireplace when he was inside. We shook hands. His hand was large, cold, and bony. He was coughing a lot. We got our first load of wood last week, I told him. Nothing changes, he said. I guess I'm a genuine teacher now, I said. He nodded and coughed. He didn't seem to want to talk. Still, I sat there, both of us gazing into the fire. Any advice? I asked him. It doesn't matter anymore, he said. Just do the best you can, but it won't matter.
Chapter 9. At 1:30, I left school to take Miss Emma into Bayonne. She came out on the porch with Tante Lou, and she had a basket hung over one arm and a handbag in the other hand. Tante Lou closed the door to keep the heat in the room, and she and Miss Emma came down the walk and out to the car. Miss Emma wore her brown overcoat with the rabbit fur around the collar and cuffs. Tante Lou wore only a sweater, so I figured she was not going to Bayonne with us. She opened the door for Miss Emma to get into the back seat, and after shutting it, she leaned against the door to continue their conversation. I am sure they had been talking all day, but still they had things to talk about. "This way is best," she said. Miss Emma may have nodded, but I am not sure. I refused to look in the mirror at them. "Anything else he need, let me know," my aunt went on. "They got plenty of old socks and shirts round the place." "I think we're supposed to be there around 2, I said, without looking back at them. I could feel both sets of eyes on the back of my neck. "Tell him I'm praying," my aunt said. "Y'all better go. I'll see you when you get back." She was talking to Miss Emma, not to me. She knew how I felt about the whole thing. I drove farther down the quarter and turned around. My aunt was standing where we had left her. She was waving now. You might have thought we were going to China instead of the 13 miles to Bayonne. Driving along the St. Charles River, I could feel Miss Emma not looking at me. Not looking at anything. Just thinking. Maybe once or twice she glanced in my direction, but most of the time she was lost in thought. Like my aunt, she knew how much I hated all this. So the 13 miles to Bayonne were driven in silence. I didn't say anything to her. She didn't say anything to me. I never looked at her in the rearview mirror. I never turned my head to the river on my right or to the houses on the side of the road to my left. As far up the highway as you could see were stalks of sugar cane that had fallen off the trailers on their way to the mill. The people were gathering pecans on either side of the road, but I looked at them only from a distance. If they waved, I did not wave back. I didn't want Miss Emma to think for a moment that my mood had changed. The courthouse, like most of the public buildings in town, was made of red brick. Built around the turn of the century, it looked like a small castle you might see in the countryside somewhere in Europe. The parking lot that surrounded the courthouse was covered with crushed seashells. A statue of a Confederate soldier stood to the right of the walk that led up to the courthouse door. Above the head of the statue, national, state, and Confederate flags flew on long metal poles. The big clock on the tower struck 2 as I parked opposite the statue and the flags. It took Miss Emma a while to get out of the car, so by the time we came into the sheriff's office, the clock on the wall there said 2:05. 2 deputies dressed in gray chinos and a colored prisoner in green coveralls with the letter P on the back were in the office. The deputy behind the desk was giving the prisoner instructions. The younger deputy, who stood beside the desk, looked at us. "I come to see Jefferson," Miss Emma said. The young deputy nodded to the deputy who was giving orders to the prisoner. It had something to do with the floor of the outside toilet. This toilet was for colored people who came to the courthouse, and it was down in the basement. You entered it from the courthouse parking lot. I had gone in there once or twice myself. but it was always filthy, and like everyone I knew, I tried to avoid going down there. But that was the only place to go. The toilets inside were for whites only. "I want that done before I leave from here," the deputy told the prisoner. "I mean that, you hear?" The prisoner, 15 or 16 years old, bowed his head and left. "I come to see my boy Jefferson," Miss Emma told the deputy behind the desk. "What you got there?" he asked her. "Just some food, some clean clothes for him," Miss Emma said. "Paul," the older man said. The deputy who stood beside the desk came toward us. "How's he been?" Miss Emma asked the deputy in charge. "Quiet," the deputy said. "Yes, sir," Miss Emma said. The deputy grinned. "Jefferson's been quiet," Paul, the young deputy, told Miss Emma. "Thank you, sir," Miss Emma said to him. The deputy went through the basket of food, fried chicken, bread, baked sweet potatoes, tea cakes. Then he went through the handbag of clothes. There was a pair of old blue jeans, an old overwashed brown shirt, a pair of long johns, and two pairs of my socks, which my aunt had given Miss Emma for Jefferson. "Empty your pockets," he said to me. I had nothing but a wallet, a handkerchief, and some loose change. I had left my keys in the car. I laid the things on the desk. "Is that it?" the deputy asked me. He had brown hair and gray-blue eyes, and he appeared to be a couple of years younger than I was. He looked pretty decent. One behind the desk didn't look decent at all. His eyes were the color of cement. He had a big neck and a fleshy face. He was much older and much heavier than Paul. Paul patted me down to see if I had taken everything out of my pockets. Then he told me that I could put my things back. "Sheriff explained everything to y'all?" the chief deputy asked us. "Sir?" Miss Emma said. Chief deputy could see that I didn't like him, and I could tell he didn't like me. But he knew who was in charge, and that I would have to take anything he dished out. "No knives, no forks, no plates. Pans," he said to Miss Emma. That was after he had looked at me a long time to let me know what he thought of me. "No hat pins, no pocket knives, no razor blades, no ice picks," he said, looking at me again. "Jefferson won't never do anything like that," Miss Emma said. "You can't ever tell," the deputy said. "Take them on up, Paul." "Follow me," the young deputy said.
That's all the time we have for today's readings from Ernest Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying. Join us at the same time next week. Thanks again for listening. If you know someone who could benefit from our service, point them in our direction. If you know someone who would like to contribute in any way, point them in our direction. You can call us at 919-832-5138 or visit our website at triangleReadingService.org. I will repeat both of those at the end of this broadcast. Once again, I'm Kirk Benrood. Our readers, Tom Haynes, Pam Vesper, Robbie Merritt, Awen Fulton, and Dan and Julie Oliver, thank you for listening. The music was supplied by Joni Madden of the Irish-American band Cherish the Ladies. Our phone number once again is 919-832-5138. Our web address once again is triangleReadingService.org.